Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the pod that looks at the money behind the beautiful game, a game that became even more beautiful about 9:45 last night. I'm Kevin Day and I'm getting ready for a European tour. And over there in Sussex is expert in football finance, Kieran Maguire, looking unnecessarily smug after Brighton assaulted Arsenal for 3 points. How are you, Kieran?
Well, I'm okay. You know, to support a club that engages in such thuggery is slightly embarrassing. And you know, I'll be sending a wreath of flowers to Arsenal.
Would have been a red card if it was rugby. That's all I'm saying.
It's not rugby.
Oh, fair point. Well, that's why you're the expert in football finance, and I'm merely the organ grinder's monkey who asks the questions. It's Monday. It's Sunday afternoon, actually, but we have to record. But it's Monday, Kieran, so it's questions day, but there's a couple of big stories that we need to get through, one of which, as ever, you predicted. It's amazing, isn't it, how you make one slight error about a team name and we get hundreds of tweets to complain. You predict a huge story and no one says a word, but you said this would happen. UEFA have temporarily relaxed financial fair play rules because of COVID. How long will temporary mean, do you think, and will the big clubs take advantage?
Well, what UEFA have said is that instead of being assessed for 2019-20, they're effectively going to add the next two seasons together. So 19-20 and 2021 will be treated as if it was a single season. And they've also said that because of coronavirus, clubs can add on the extra broadcast money, prize money, gate receipts, sponsorship money that they would have received had the seasons not been disrupted. How long is it going to go on for? It, to a certain extent, it's a great unknown because we don't know when mass gathering events will be sanctioned by individual countries and individual governments. From UEFA's point of view, they're quite nervous, if you think about it, because they're representative of 55, 56 different countries across Europe, some of which might be returning and others not. And that could have huge implications for Champions League and Europa League.
And is there a chance that big clubs will take advantage of this, that they will maybe spend more on transfers than they would have done? Or will UEFA be making sure that people don't use this as a loophole to get out of things?
Well, UEFA have said that they are going to be checking the numbers with a great deal of scrutiny to prevent this. The one thing you're not allowed to adjust your numbers for is player sales. And I think that could have an impact upon those clubs who you might refer to as development clubs. You know, the clubs that are good at spotting the players for, you know, in the 5 to 10 million pound bracket and then selling them on within a year or two for a multiple of that, because as we've said on a few occasions, the transfer market, except for the very elite, is likely to collapse. So it's not necessarily a completely equitable stance taken by UEFA, but it's difficult to know what else they could have done.
Now, Timo Werner is going to Chelsea. Now, normally, as a straightforward transfer story, it wouldn't bother us because we're football finance. But it's going to cost Chelsea £100 million, Kieran. £100 million.
Yeah, and I think this is intriguing in the sense of when clubs do sign a player, they say, well, how much is the total cost to us in respect of the guy arriving? So if we take a look at Werner, he wanted to come to the Premier League because that's where the money at. So his agent's getting £12 million from this, which is quite good. The release clause on the contract is 52 million. And I think release clauses are an interesting one. We're hoping to get a football lawyer on the show this week. So they might be able to explain that a little bit clearer than my knowledge. His wages are going to double. His wages are going from around about 4 million a year to 9 million a year. So you put all of those together, and that gives a total cost of about £109 million over the 5 years. And that's before, I suspect, that you start to factor in the bonuses. So it is costly. And that's why so many clubs are looking at the prospects of Bosmans. If you think about the likes of Ibrahimovic and Aaron Ramsey, they've earned huge sums of wages, probably more than the likes of Timo Werner. And the reason why they can afford to do that is that the transfer fee's not being paid, and therefore that's actually being replaced by higher wages.
Yeah, only an accountant would say £12 million was quite good. That's quite good, 12 million quid. And also, I'm intrigued by the news that we're getting a lawyer on. It's nice that I find these things out from you, Kieran, rather than some kind of formal message from the producer. But I'm just amazed that we found a lawyer who obviously hasn't listened to the podcast, because you've spent 9 months pretty much insulting them on every pod we've done. So I'm pleased that we found one who's big enough to come on and take that on the chin.
No, they listen to the show. I get a lot of comments from lawyers, and I myself appeared on Law in Sport a few weeks ago. They don't mind it. Yeah, you know, they quite happy take the stick and then just invoice for it.
Yes, I it's a measure of my relationship with you, Kieran. When you said I've appeared, I automatically assumed the second part of that sentence was going to be in court quite often. but I'm pleased to hear it wasn't.
Now, I'm the black sheep of the family on that one.
Well, that amazes me, because I see what you mean. Because you haven't appeared in court, I see. It was a reverse. I got yes, because your family are all associates, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Newcastle have announced unequivocally, finally, that they will refund the season ticket holders, Kieran.
Yes, Newcastle were the last club to effectively publish their accounts, and they're the last club to announce refunds. They don't really have much of a choice in the matter, because there is consumer protection law, and they failed to deliver 19 matches where people can attend. But at least they have got round to announcing it. I think in an ideal world, Mike Ashley would have put the sale through earlier this year, a couple of months ago, and then left it to the new owners to have to deal with. But as the owners and directors test issues are dragging on, and we were discussing that earlier last week, yeah. I suspect the club felt that they couldn't continue to show a deaf ear to fans. And many fans will say, keep the money, or I'll put it towards next year's season ticket. And one disappointing thing, though, in respect of this, whilst they have given fans, or will be giving fans, should I say, a refund for 2019-20, those fans who have taken up the early bird offers for 2021, and let's face it, we don't know whether matches are going to take place before a paying audience. It's highly unlikely when the season starts that's going to be the case. They've said, oh, we'll make a decision later. So, fans who've stumped up money early for whatever reason, it could be that they get a discount, could be that they wanted to support the club. Their circumstances might have changed since then, and they won't be given the opportunity of a refund for the foreseeable future.
We've talked on several occasions in the past couple of weeks, Kieran, about fans donating their refund back to the club or back to an academy or back to the foundation. But in an area like Newcastle, which has been severely hit by COVID and by austerity in the past, if I was a Newcastle fan, knowing that a takeover was imminent by basically the Saudi government, I'd be reluctant to donate my refund back to the club in those circumstances, to be quite honest.
Yeah, and I think given the toxic relationship between Mike Ashley and the fan base, whereas I think we've seen for the majority of the smaller clubs, when fans have been able to afford to do so, where their circumstances have allowed them to do so, the majority have said, we'll either give the money to the club charity or to an NHS fund or back to the club itself, which has been fantastic. And if they can't afford to, due to personal circumstances, then nobody should be giving them any stick. But in the case of Ashley, I can't see many people wanting to give money back to him, given that he's going to be trousering £300 million from the sale of the club.
Yeah, Scunthorpe fans don't have the option, though, because unfortunately Scunthorpe United have announced that they can't afford to offer season ticket refunds.
Yeah, and this one seemed there's a few strange things in respect of Scunthorpe. They've said it's going to cost them £100,000. I think they've got four remaining home fixtures. They have said that you can offset the money due to your 2021 season ticket, or the club can keep it and you pay the full amount for your 2021 season ticket. Practically every other club has done the same and also said, well, if you want to have a refund, we'll arrange one. If you take a look at Scunthorpe, the club's got debts of £11 million, which it's run up to a company called Cool Silk, which is owned by the club owner. Cool Silk is charged thick end of £300,000 in interest last year, and if the club's genuinely got no money, then I'm still not convinced that that's in agreement with consumer protection law. But it really doesn't help in exactly the same week as this takes place, the owner goes along and buys a racehorse for £165,000.
Oh, really?
Now that's what's called a tin ear, I think, in the business.
Yes.
Scunthorpe as a club, the owners have been very supportive. Over the last 7 years, it's not been run as a business. You know, the total income, 24 million, wages, 34. So, they've been spending far more in order to try to be successful, and it hasn't really paid off. They've dropped, they had a few years in League One, but then dropped into League Two. But I don't think it looks too clever. Have a little bit of common sense. Don't go buying trophy assets such as racehorses if you say you've got no money. And I appreciate they're separate businesses, but it just doesn't look too clever.
Yeah, one day you and I will buy a racehorse together from the money we make from this pod. A tiny, tiny little racehorse called The Price of Football. It still amazes me. We've been doing this for the best part of a year now, and it still amazes me when I hear you say a club's not been run as a business. But there you go. Finally, before we get on to questions, Macclesfield have been deducted points, as you predicted, but not enough to relegate them. Excuse the pun, but what's the point in so the points deduction is no sort of punishment at all then, really, is it?
Well, it's not. I mean, Macclesfield have failed to play the wages on time at least six times during the season. So the players went on strike. Clearly, there's a poor relationship between the club owner and the players, and the club owner and the EFL, and the club owner and the fans, because the fans don't know what's happening from week to week. Our match is going to be fulfilled, and so on. So it went to yet another EFL charge. They've already, I think they had around about 11 points deducted to date this season. And if they'd had 3 points deducted, they would have been relegated to the National League.
Yeah.
But instead, it was a 2-point deduction with a 4-point suspended sentence and a £20,000 fine.
Yeah.
And it just makes you wonder, how on earth do they come up with these numbers? I don't know whether they've been to the FA and have borrowed the jar which you put the balls in for the for the FA Cup draw and say, it's just a random yeah. points deduction generator. Stevenage fans are completely upset, as you can understand.
Yeah.
Macclesfield fans are relieved, as you can perfectly understand. But how these decisions are being made, there's no consistency. There seems to be no logic. And Nicola Palios, who's one of the owners at Tranmere, she tweeted on Friday night when this came through, that the clubs themselves don't know what's going to happen because there seems to be no set tariff. Nobody knows in advance, and it just seems to be very, very random.
Yeah, well, in effect, all they've been given is a £20,000 fine because the points deduction has no relevance at all. I imagined that they would be saying, right, you'll start next season on minus 4 points or whatever it was. And I suspect we haven't heard the last of this because the noises coming out of Stevenage were very much that they expected Macclesfield to be deducted enough points to keep Stevenage safe. So we probably need to get that lawyer we're having on the show next week on quite quickly before Stevenage retain his services. But again, I think we'll be hearing more from, certainly from Macclesfield over the course of the summer. Anyway, on to questions, because it is Monday, it is our questions pod, and we have got some very interesting questions today. The first is from Philip Whitaker. You'll like this, Kieran. I say that as though you don't already know what the first question is, because you like some time to research, whereas I like enough time to roll out of bed and pick open up the website, the email. Philip Whitaker, this is a proper, sorry, it's Sunday, and I celebrated Palace winning last night. Philip Whitaker, of course you did, but you and I celebrate in very different ways. How is the Baroness this morning? Is she okay?
Yeah, she made me some Marmite and cheese bread, which is absolutely brilliant, absolutely amazing stuff. Uh-huh. So, yeah, that's how I rock, Previn. You know.
Yeah. Did you call me Previn then?
Previn, yes. I've Andre'd you up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one for the kids. Yeah, well, I think that's the difference between in our lifestyles is that if Marmite and cheese between two slices of bread, I will just about give you, but bread made of Marmite and cheese, that'll go nicely with a pheasant, I imagine. that sounds lovely. Marmite peanut butter is gorgeous. Anyway, perhaps if we mention that again, they'll send us some free jars. Philip Whitaker's good question. It's a proper accounting question. What impact, says Philip Whitaker, what impact will expanding the season have on end-of-year accounts? Will clubs stick to their normal reporting cycle? And will it make future comparisons impossible?
If I answer the second question first, making the figures comparable over on a historic basis, yeah, they won't be. It's because clubs will have been hit so significantly from the impact of coronavirus in terms of broadcasting rebates and rebates on tickets. So, yeah, everybody's going to take a hit this year. I don't think clubs will change their year end because, as we've already mentioned, financial fair play is going to be spread over two seasons until effectively the end of June 21. So therefore, it doesn't really impact upon clubs because one of the key issues in terms of producing your accounts is for FFP submission.
Okay, right. We got a question from a regular contributor, a Millwall fan, Dave Baccarini, who we have previously said sounds like he probably knows your family from Bermondsey. This is an interesting question, though, because we often talk about parachute payments. And Dave's question, firstly, is how were the values of parachute payments decided in the first place? And by what amount could they be reduced to minimise the disadvantage to clubs like Millwall, but still provide a safety blanket for relegated clubs from the Premier League?
Well, in terms of the first element of the question, parachute payments are calculated as a percentage of the money which is given out by the Premier League on an equal distribution basis. And I think we've discussed this before. There's three or four pots of money as far as the Premier League is concerned. Half the money is allocated evenly between clubs. A quarter is split between the positions of the club. So you get, it's effectively worked out as about £2.5 million per each place you go up the table. And the third pot is determined by how often you're on TV. So the first pot is the one which is the critical one. And if it's your first year in the Championship, you get 55% of the equal distribution. That drops to 45% in year two and 20% in year three. So it's all down to our favourites, you know, algorithms, etc. Yeah. And it's easy to calculate in advance to a certain extent. So the Premier League having to give a rebate to the broadcasters this year will have an impact upon those clubs who are in receipt of parachute payments next year. But I think more importantly, it will have an impact on EFL clubs in Leagues 1 and 2 and the Championship in what are referred to as solidarity payments, because those are also linked to the equal distribution pot.
Oh, that's interesting. Just so I can get this straight, you're not implying that the three clubs that get relegated from the Premier League this season will all get the same parachute payment, though? Will they, or
Yeah, yeah. They'll all get 55% of what will be given to all of the Premier League clubs terms of the amount that's being split evenly.
Right. So of all seasons, this is not a brilliant one to get relegated, is it?
Yeah, it's going to be an absolute nightmare if you go down this year, because the Championship's not going to have revenue coming in next season from fans, certainly for the first few months in all probability, and you're getting lower parachute payments, but not necessarily being able to cut your wages as quickly as you would like.
Yeah. Okay, our next question comes from Guy Fraser. And this is an interesting one as well. They're all interesting questions, but this is something that hadn't occurred to me. Guy wonders whether part of the Premier League team's desire not to play at neutral grounds was down to advertising sponsorship. And he asks this for two reasons. Would they have had to repay advertising contracts if matches weren't held at their own ground? And with little other sport going on, could they actually bump up the prices for the rest of the season? I think you should point out, Guy, that not every club didn't want to play at neutral grounds. It tended to be the bottom six, clubs like Brighton, for example. But for the most part, several clubs were very, very keen to maintain home advantage, which, of course, we all assume was for playing reasons. But Guy is wondering whether there were other reasons for that as well, Kieran. I think that's an interesting point.
Yeah, it's one which has been looked at. If you take a look at the Premier League were initially considering playing in 8, 9, 10 grounds around the country. But if you think about it, some grounds have naming rights. So yeah, we've got the Etihad, the Emirates, the Vitality, the Amex, and so on. So those companies have paid for the naming rights of their stadium. And there could have been winners or losers there, because if the Emirates had been chosen for the neutral venues, then more matches would have taken place there. So therefore, the Emirates would have been happy. If that stadium had not been chosen, they would have been unhappy and therefore might have asked for some money back. In terms of general adverts, most adverts these days, as you've probably seen, and this is actually a Premier League rule, perimeter advertising tends to be LED based.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite easy to recalibrate those. So if Liverpool had been playing at Burnley for their neutral fixture, then Liverpool could still have sold that advertising themselves. So that shouldn't have been a problem. However, what you would lose out is many times if you take a look at stadia, the seats themselves are in there's a logo of a sponsor, and there's other adverts placed around which aren't around the perimeter of the ground, which would have necessitated some rebates. I don't think they would have been huge though. Right. Because the main money, my understanding is you're on around about 10 to 12 times as much for perimeter advertising, that's the stuff with the advertising random betting sites and insurance companies and so on, than for the static boards, which tend to come from sort of more local businesses.
Now, something's just occurred to me, Kieran, because as you say, watching every Premier League game this weekend, you see a wide array of products being advertised on the LED, not all of them in English, and many of them for companies it's hard to decipher what actually they are offering. But will a club like Bournemouth yesterday, for example, if you've got 10 different companies displaying adverts during the 90 minutes, will Bournemouth have done 10 different deals with those companies, or will they go through one sort of central agent who sells the advertising space on their behalf?
Well, I think there's a few things here. The Premier League does agree some deals effectively on behalf of the league as a whole.
Right.
So therefore, you will see some adverts. I think one of them's from a Turkish hair replacement clinic, which I think that's negotiated centrally. And what happens is that you pay for 30-second slots.
Right.
So the Premier League will have negotiated some of those on behalf of the whole of the Premier League, and then it is down as a rule for the club's commercial directors. And I've been trying to persuade one or two commercial directors to come on onto the show to explain how it operates. And we're making slow progress. So hopefully we'll have some news on that soon.
Do you know what? In my experience, commercial directors in any organisation are the ones who are more likely to stay stunned than anybody else. They're like oysters. You can't get anything out of commercial people. On the subject of shirt sponsorship, advertising and sponsorship in general, I missed the days. Palace's first sponsor were a local pet shop, essentially. And I missed days like that. But this question is for Will Grieve, who I assume is a Leighton Orient fan, because Will Grieve has said that with Leighton Orient announcing that Harry Kane is taking up their shirt sponsorship, mainly to display charities on the front of the shirts. How can clubs generate income, says Will, if they have charities on the front of the shirt, like UNICEF, for example, at Barcelona? Or do clubs who have charities on their shirt not necessarily need income from shirt sponsorship?
Well, I think it's a good question from Will. But by the sounds of it, Harry Kane is effectively taking on the cost that Leighton Orient would normally charge to a shirt sponsor, which is a fantastic gesture from him. You know, yeah. He acknowledges the place that club has had in the development of his career. But in terms of charities, quite often the club owner or the club board will make a decision that we want to be associated with something different. Under Premier League rules, I think you're allowed one or two games a season where the traditional sponsor can forego what's on the front of the shirt, and that can be replaced by a charity. So it is embedded into Premier League contracts. But it will cost clubs if they decide to go with a charity. If you referred to Barcelona, Barcelona were paying UNICEF £1.5 million a year for the right to have UNICEF on the front of their shirts. That was around about 2010, 2011-ish, I think, which was fantastic. I think it was a really classy act at the time. Yeah. But since then, what other sponsors are prepared to pay for the big clubs is so much that relatively few clubs can these days afford to turn it down.
Yeah, it's noticeable that Man City had one of their own charities, Citizens, for their game on Wednesday, didn't they? We'll have more from Barcelona later, a slightly less positive story. Sean Ryan is one of our many American listeners. Sean's in San Francisco. Hello, Sean. I hope you're safe and well. It's a short question, but it's an interesting one. Sean wants to know why there are so few player exchanges in football compared to American sport. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. We are living in an era of information overload, and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level, as for somebody whose life is quite chaotic, and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content, I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book, I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Well, I think there's a number of issues here. First of all, if you think about transfers between players here in England, we're recruiting from the Premier League is recruiting from the EFL. The Premier League is recruiting from Scotland, Spain, Bulgaria, Italy. The pool of players is huge. So there has to be some form of trading mechanism. The NFL is a single company, which sends out franchises. And rather than player giving clubs compensation for developing players, which effectively a transfer fee is to a certain extent, remember you've got the draft system in the NFL and the NBA, and that means that the cost of developing players is actually being borne by colleges. And US college sport and the scandal of US college sport is something which I'm always been amazed that has got so little interest. Because these kids don't get paid when they're at college, and quite often they get injured, and you know it's quite brutal sports that they're playing in. Yeah. So those are the contributory factors. Also, if you look at football, many clubs, and I think I referred to this earlier in the pod, have what we refer to as a development model. So that, you know, the likes of Brentford, where they try to talent spot, develop a player for a couple of years, sell on a profit. That's because on a day-to-day basis, they're losing money. In American sports, everybody is making money because right. of the salary caps that they've got, because of the centralization of income. And because income is being centralized, everybody's getting the same amount. So therefore, you don't need to pay the transfer fees.
Now, that's a very good answer. It's a very clear answer. But just one point. American college sport, whether it's football, basketball, whatever, is huge. I mean, they get huge crowds. So when you say those kids don't get paid, do you mean they don't get paid or, inverted commas, they don't get paid?
No, they do not. They don't get a bean. They might get a scholarship.
Right.
American universities are huge. I mean, I did some teaching at Stanford probably about 15 years ago, and I went to look at their facilities, and they were just stunning. You know, they were better than 70 of the stadia that you would see here in the UK for professional football. Absolutely amazing. But it is simply just a production line. And then, of course, the draft system does sort of equalize the talent between clubs. But you know, they are not. And I think it's one of the things that the NFL monitors very carefully, to make sure that there are no abuses. I mean, some of the scholarships might be quite generous from the universities themselves, because they make so much money from college sports, because you've got, you know, 30,000 people turning up. They've got very lucrative TV deals. And unlike football here in the UK, where so much of the money instantly disappears in wages, that just simply goes straight into university coffers.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. I mentioned a Barcelona question, and it comes from Dara Martin. It's something we have sort of touched on peripherally, which is, I'm quite proud I managed to pronounce that with the hangover I've got. But Dara Martin's question is, last year Barcelona signed 16-year-old Louis Barry from West Brom. There was quite a lot of publicity about it. They signed him for £235,000, but they didn't pay the money. Then Louis Barry signed for Villa. Now, Dara's question is a simple one. How is that possible? How can Barcelona move him on without actually paying for him? And who gets the money for that Villa signing? And basically, are Barca taking the piss out of West Brom?
Well, Barcelona do appear to be in breach of financial fair play. Whilst we tend to think of financial fair play as all about wage caps and break-even models and so on, if you go into the small print of the UEFA FFP regulations, and I wouldn't recommend that with a hangover,
I'm not doing it full stop, Kieran, hangover or no hangover. your job. My job is reading questions out loud, basically. Your job is small print. Come on now.
Another element is what's referred to as the football payables rule, and you have to settle your football debts. So I think West Bromwich Albion will be pursuing Barcelona via FIFA or via UEFA for the non-payment for Louis Barry. So they sold him for $235,000. I went onto the Barcelona website, and one of the great things about these big clubs is that they do publish them, of course, in multiple languages.
Yeah.
They sold Louis Barry, I think, for €1.05 million. So clearly they've done very well in the 6 months that the young man's been at the club. they would have to give West Brom a proportion of that in what's known as a development fee. Because if you sign a player who is young and you sell him on, then the club who had him as a youth player is entitled to a share of that transfer fee. So West Brom should be getting not just the 235 grand, but also a proportion of the just over the 1 million euros that Barcelona have from the sale of Barry to Villa.
That's a big should, isn't it, by the sound of it?
Yes.
You can't imagine that it would be high on Barcelona's priorities, which is a shame. Now, Fraser Lloyd-Davies is a Plymouth Argyle fan, so I'm sure he'll be delighted to hear me be the millionth person to say they are a huge club who should be in the Premier League with that catchment area. As all everybody says about Plymouth, a massive club. I have a soft spot for Plymouth Argyle, but mainly because my first proper girlfriend was at college in Plymouth. Obviously, I didn't spend Saturday afternoons going to see Plymouth play, but I love the city. Fraser's question, is there a way Plymouth Argyle could realistically get to the Championship, if not further, without ditching their new approach to financial sustainability? Or will we inevitably have to splash out to move on up the pyramid? So the first question, before you answer that second question, is what is their new approach to financial sustainability?
Well, Plymouth have got an owner called Simon Hallett, and he's a fan of the pod as well. He has texted us and so on. So it's always nice to get things like that. He has invested in the club, and he said his aim is to make it better at generating income. So money's being put into the infrastructure, but I also think he's trying to increase the range of facilities through which the club can generate money with a view to making it effectively self-financing. Can you get up to the Championship on a break-even model? Well, Plymouth lost £1.4 million in the last 6 months of their account. So, you know, they show the struggles involved. But if you take a look at the likes of Burton, Shrewsbury and Rotherham, you know, there are clubs who do operate a really tight budget, and their focus is on trying to get young managers, trying to get development through the academy and so on. And they've all managed to get up to the Championship, or Shrewsbury are being fairly close to it. And certainly when I've spoken to chief executives at clubs, a lot of them have said sort of the Shrewsbury and Burton model, they see them as sort of the litmus test. You know, that's something we need to follow if we need to cut our losses. So it can be done, but it's really tough, because if you take a look at Burton and Rotherham, every time they've gone up, they've tended to last, you know, one or two seasons in the Championship in recent years. But, you know, good luck to them for taking such an approach. It is achievable, but it's a tough task.
Now, on a purely cynical money point of view, you and I, Kieran, support teams that have been in the same division as Plymouth back in the day, and they take huge numbers of fans to away games. Because, I mean, considering the distance, it's incredible how many fans they take to away games. My mate Bristol Mark is a Plymouth season ticket holder, and it always makes me laugh that his nickname's Bristol Mark and he's a Plymouth fan. But again, he goes home and away, and they still take huge numbers. I mean, this is a club. I'm amazed that somebody hasn't, a billionaire hasn't, because this is a club that would get 35,000 fans in the Premier League. I mean, this is a club that could be the size of Leeds United, only in Devon, couldn't it, really? So it seems there is money to be made from Plymouth. So it's even more admirable that a club like Plymouth aren't sort of selling the farm and risking all on getting into the Championship, the Premier League, isn't it?
Very much so. And, you know, I think it's good to have new owners coming in. And it's the first thing that they say quite often is, well, I'm going to splash this money. Or they're trying to get some acceptance and affectation from fans. But here, Simon Hallett has come in, and the fans have bought into this. You know, that they like the idea of what he's trying to do in terms of developing the ground. And they can see the longer term benefits. And sometimes it's better to build a club from foundations rather than just splashing the cash on new transfers.
Yeah, I agree. If Simon Hallett is listening, he might be able to shed light on this mystery as well, because there are a lot of Plymouth fans who will tell you that the name romantically comes from the fact that the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders were, for some reason, based in Devon during the Victorian times. I think it's more to do with the fact there's a massive pub called the Argyll Arms right in the centre of Plymouth. But maybe Simon could shed some light on that for us. You've already partly answered this next question. This next question comes from Amber Holloway. Hello, Amber. Amber says it seems easy to collect financial data on English clubs because you just go to Company's House. But where can you find financial data for clubs in other major European leagues? And is it easy to understand or translate? So you've told us that Barcelona's accounts are readily available and in English as well. Is that the same for most major European clubs?
I think for major clubs, yeah, quite often that is the case. Certainly I've looked at the likes of Dortmund and Real and so on. PSG, they give you what they want you to see in English. So you have to delve a bit further. This is an area where I do think the UK leads as far as Europe is concerned, because all clubs have to submit to Companies House, and that is freely available. And it used to cost money every time you took a set of accounts from Companies House, but I think they changed that in around about 2005. And for me, it's one of the biggest steps forwards in terms of analysis, because it allows me to monitor all 92 in England and all 44 in Scotland. Was it 42? So
can we get it right before we, because it's me that gets the tweets.
Yeah, also, 40 something.
Yeah, so that would be fine. Yeah, yeah. I imagine you've got some kind of season ticket at Company's House, haven't you? I guess in a pleasingly 50s way, there's a commissionaire who tips his hat as you come in.
I'm on first name terms.
I was going to say, yeah, yes. Morning, Kieran. All right, who is it today? Bournemouth. Okay, I'll get them for you.
it's not as good. It's not as transparent in Europe. We've got different companies, different countries with different legislation. And it's far more spotty. Some clubs will, of course, publish in their native language, and this is where, because I'm a Brit and my language skills aren't good. I mean, I did Latin at school, so there's not many clubs publishing in that, which is a shame.
Yeah, but as we've learned, you've got enough Russian to get by.
Well, I only knew about three words, but that was all I needed.
three very important words, Kieran. That's fine.
So certainly when I'm looking for European data, I always go to the Swiss Rambo on Twitter, because he does speak at least four languages fluently. He's very much a cunning linguist, and he's the man that does all the hard work. And I just go and note it down and add it to my spreadsheet.
I knew that was coming. And also, I know that Guy listens to the pod, our producer. I could just hear a slight cough in the background when you recommended another football finance podcast.
He just tweets.
Yeah, yeah. So there's no UEFA regulations then that says that clubs have to make their accounts transparent.
No, because UEFA. I think this is one of the things that the football authorities should be doing. And certainly I've been sniping at the EFL, which is why they hate me, and the FA for failing to increase transparency in the game in this regard. But there seems to be no desire for this to be the case from the football authorities themselves.
Yeah, the EFL don't hate you, Kieran. Some of the clubs in it do. But it's a sign of respect, isn't it? Hate is how I like to think of it. it's in a way that I really respect Brighton. You know, that sort of.
That's right. Well, looking at the comments from Arsenal fans about Neil Mopay last night on social media, they've clearly got a lot of respect for him.
Yeah, do you know what? That was the first time watching that game yesterday where I genuinely wondered what the outcome would have been if fans, because it would have been right in front of the Arsenal fans, and I wonder if the referee would have reacted differently. Anyway, that's for a different pod, because it's got nothing to do with football finance. Now, our final question, and again, it's quite a big one, but it's an interesting one. It comes from Gypster. If I've pronounced that wrong, I apologise, but it's just Gypster. I thought it was Ginster initially, obviously, so I was very pleased to be getting a question from a Cornish pasty magnate, but it's Gypster. And Gypster's talk about it's likely, says Gypster, I'm not as optimistic as he is, but it's likely in the coming months that a government report will give a green light to safe standing being at least considered across the Premier League and the Championship. And his question is, as a Leeds season ticket holder, what are the financial implications for individual clubs and also for individual fans where fans around them are already standing up anyway, to be perfectly honest? And he's talking about not just replacing seats, but also stewarding first aid costs, etc.
Well, you know, what we have at present is unsafe standing.
Yes.
You know, I go, you and I both go to matches. Yeah. Whenever I go to an away game, I've not sat down at an away game for God knows how many years, despite you know the half-hearted attempts of stewards who've got a nightmare job with regards to this.
Yeah.
Under the Taylor report, of course, we have all-seater stadia in England. That doesn't apply to Scotland. So what we are seeing is Celtic introduced what's referred to as safe standing or railed standing.
Yeah.
And sort of looking at the finances of this, a lot will depend upon the safety certificate, which is granted to the club, because how many people standing are you going to get for each seat? Looking at the different models, it's somewhere between one and two. So if you take a club such as Hanover, they replaced 3,000 seats with 5,700 standing area. So clearly they will generate more money in that regard. The cost to stand is cheaper, but the overall revenue is actually higher. So that if that is the case, that would be more than the cost of first aid facilities, stewarding, and so on. And I think the only extra stewarding cost should be, in theory, is that you have one steward per X number of fans. So if you increase the capacity of stadia as a result of introducing rail seating, then there would be increased stewarding costs, but these would be insignificant compared to the extra revenue that clubs would generate, unless there are it's a one-for-one exchange and the safety advisory people say we want more stewards as an initial approach. I know that Manchester United, they're trying to get safe standing.
Yeah.
If you have you been to the new Spurs stadium?
I have, yeah. First
in the away end. Well, yeah, that's geared month. For rail seating.
Yeah.
And that seems to be quite good. You know, a new stadium is effectively being future-proofed. So I think actually that there is the potential to make money out of standing if you are getting, you know, 1.4 plus people standing for every one seat that's being foregone.
Yeah, it's clear, Kieran, when you go to away games in the Premier League that a lot of clubs, and I think Palace are one of them, have kind of decided to turn a blind eye to standing in certain areas where, you know, traditionally the more robust fans go. I think as long as people don't take the piss, clubs are happy to let that happen. And as you say, at away games, I think stewards more or less give up. I mean, if you've got 3,000 Brighton fans, Palace fans at Watford, and they're all standing up, you can make as many announcements as you like over the PA. They're not going to sit down. But and I know there are a lot of people who say that the advent of all-seater stadiums was when working-class fans started to get priced out of the game. So clubs will have to charge less if you're standing, won't they? But how much less do you think clubs would charge? I mean, if you're paying £30 for a seat at Selhurst Park, how much do you think Steve Parish would want to charge to stand at Selhurst Park?
I don't think clubs would be expecting to pay less. When I go to a gig, I pay the same whether I'm standing or sitting. In fact, that doesn't tend to bother me.
Right.
So as a football fan, the quality of the seats is so crap that fair you're not finish, actually yeah, getting point. Any benefit, or you're getting a wee bit of extra space. But even so, when I've been to Old Trafford as an away fan, you're absolutely sardined into the seats and you're still paying top dollar. So if there is a discount, I think it will be a nominal one. And therefore, clubs potentially could make more money from this if you increase the number of people standing by 40% and you cut the costs by 10%. Then you know the clubs could be a bit of in benefit.
Yeah, I was trying to think of examples where you would not be happy to pay as much. To the only thing I could come up with is the Globe Theatre which I go to a lot. And of course, I always pay to sit down. I wouldn't be happy to pay the same money to sit down at the Globe as I would pay to stand, but that's blowing my credentials as a down-to-earth working-class football fan. That's interesting. I mean, I think my guess is, Kieran, that you probably think the same way as I do, that safe standing should come back. I can understand why Liverpool would be one of the clubs that are reluctant to commit to it. Of course, we would all understand that. But I think for a lot of fans, a safe standing area would be a welcome return, wouldn't it?
Yes, yes. And I think the Spirit of Shankly, which is one of the Liverpool fan groups, you know, they asked their members, and overwhelmingly, I think they would welcome safe standing. You know, what happened at Hillsborough, that we should never forget, was down to the incompetence of the people organising that fixture and policing that fixture and stewarding that fixture. It wasn't down to having terraces per se. If there hadn't been cages in those days, if football fans had been treated as people instead of, you know, herded animals, then, you know, that would have helped as well.
Yeah, and if people like Lord Justice Popplewell had taken the opportunity after the Bradford fire report to remove fences, as was recommended by safety experts, that Hillsborough wouldn't have happened. You're absolutely right. We should never forget that. You're absolutely right. That was the last question from Gipster. As ever, they've been interesting questions, and I really enjoy the questions, but I love the news pod, Kieran. Of course I do. Any half hour I get to spend in your company, albeit remotely, is a pleasure, Kieran. If you have, I don't know why you're laughing. I was genuinely trying to be sincere there, but in that middle-aged bloke way, you just go, "Oh, well, I'll have to laugh at this." I sent a nice message to my friend Roy last week, who asked us a question, and all my other mates just accused me of being soft for saying nice things about somebody we love. It's a terrible male thing to do. If you have questions for us, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. We will be back on Thursday after some more football games. It's brilliant to have it back. And it'd be lovely to have you back too. So, Kieran, have a good next couple of days, and I'll see you soon.
Thank you very much. Stay safe, boys and girls.
Thank you. You didn't say that last time. A lot of people commented on it. They said, why does he not want us to stay safe this weekend? It's your catchphrase. See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Price of Football. The Price of Football.